sense of neglecting an entire dimension of one's life and personality. By nurturing these areas consistently throughout life, the successful business professional will greatly increase the likelihood of deriving maximum fulfillment from his or her life. This may make him or her less susceptible to what, in Levin's case, sounds a lot like a search for meaning in life. Maintaining a Benzoma state of life balance makes it much easier to resist the temptation of premature retirement. Instead of promising yourself that you will play golf, read good books, and enjoy time with the family when you retire, you should heed Benzoma's advice and take constant little slices of retirement, as it were, each and every day of your life. Jews have a word that captures this essential theme of constantly confronting multi-front challenges. The word is shalem, from which is derived the far better known shalom, meaning peace. The root meaning of the word is totality, or comprehensiveness. Its peace connotation stems from the altogether reasonable principle that authentic and lasting peace is merely an illusion if both parties to the conflict do not feel they have been made whole and complete. The word shalem is often used in the context of human development, implying that people must constantly work on all four zones of their humanity in order to try to achieve a totality. Does anyone really want to be rich and lonely? Does anyone really want to be wise but unhealthy? Of course not. So as appealing as it may be to block out all distractions and only focus your attentions on the one specialized area of your obsession, such is not the road to success. In this sense, Judaism frowns on specialization. I may have to specialize in my professional occupation, but I should not do so in the totality of my life. Jews have always found inspiration in one particular scriptural account that revolves around the word shalem. After Shechem, a Hivite prince, raped Jacob's daughter Dinah, he wished to marry her. Hoping to persuade his own people to accept Jacob's family, the about-to-be-formed children of Israel, Shechem uttered the following words, "These people are shalem with us. Let them settle in our land and trade in it." Ancient Jewish tradition interprets Shechem's words this way. "These people, Jacob's family, will make us shalem, or whole." Every nation lacks some resources that must be imported from elsewhere and can export its own products in exchange. In order for this to take place, every nation needs businessmen and traders. Jacob's family are natural traders, and by importing our needs, they will make us shalem, or whole. Paradoxically, Jewish tradition teaches that only by not specializing, only by not excluding all the essence of life from your endeavors, will those endeavors be blessed. In other words, don't specialize. A caveat is in order here. Achieving truly spectacular success and international prominence in any field does mean that you will have to sacrifice most other regions of your life. For example, if you wish to compete in the next Olympic Games, you won't have much of a life for the next 4 years. Similarly, the late Golda Meir, former Prime Minister of Israel, once poignantly told a group of young women how her political aspirations and desire to lead the State of Israel penalized her marriage and her family. Are you driven to reach the very top of the heap in business? If so, you might give your family and friends ample warning and advise them to check back with you once a decade. However, this book is not for those people. This book is for those of you who desire wealth, real but not mind-numbing wealth, along with a life. You face another paradox. If you spend all your time and vitality exclusively trying to make money, you will make less than if you had properly balanced your efforts in all four vital areas of human motivation. This has always been one of the big secrets of the Jewish approach to money. Biblical figures are almost all larger than life, three-dimensional personalities. Although the oral Torah describes many of them as fabulously wealthy, this does not usually emerge directly from the text. This is because wealth is considered to be the consequence of a life well lived, in the company and companionship of others doing the same, rather than a purpose of life in itself. These biblical characters were, for the most part, exciting people, passionately involved in complex, multi-tiered relationships with others. So, not surprisingly, they became wealthy. Wealth was consequence, and not a prime purpose. Here is a tantalizing glimpse into the daily 19th century life of the Seligmans, one of the wealthiest Jewish families ever in the United States. Listen to this observation from Prince Andrei Poniatowski, a nephew of King Stanislaus of Poland, who visited the wealthy Seligman family of New York in 1892. After doing business with the Seligman's bank, and after visiting the family in both their town and summer homes, here is what the prince wrote home. Money in itself, however, had no significance for them outside of business. Any observer listening to their talk during leisure hours would have taken them for good rentiers, given to sport, literature, art, and especially to music, who contributed generously to charity and still more to the finances of their political party, and above all, were devoted to family life, with an intensity to be met with today only in the French provinces. The enduring point revealed by the Seligman lifestyle is that certain things are best not pursued directly. Mountain peaks are almost never scaled by the direct approach. Successful climbers plot what usually turns out to be a long and circuitous assault. At times, it probably even appears as if the climbing party is traveling away from rather than toward its summit destination. Nonetheless, that is the nature of mountain peaks. Sometimes people find themselves in adversarial relationships. Nations find themselves at war. Individuals find themselves in fights, both professionally and domestically. In these situations, it is usually a bad mistake to pursue peace directly. If peace is the only objective, then the means of achieving it are easy, merely surrender. A genuine peace with which both parties can live for the long term may only be achievable in the wake of conflict. Peace is just one of those things that is best pursued indirectly. Another is happiness. There are many things you can do to instill happiness in yourself. They include hard work and achievement, durable relationships, and, in fact, pretty much the four main motivators I presented a few pages earlier. However, desperate and determined attempts to pursue happiness directly often lead to spurious emotional substitutes and damaging excursions into the dark world of alcohol and other chemical abuse. Prince Andrei Poniatowski learned from the Seligmans that money and wealth are exactly like mountain peaks, peace and happiness. Attempts to pursue any one of them directly are seldom the most effective route. Acknowledge your negative attributes. Great athletic coaches have told me that when commencing work with a promising young athlete, their first task is to help him or her get rid of some accumulated bad habits. Only after that has been accomplished can the coach begin the task of teaching the right way to run, or to hit, throw, or kick a ball. This principle of banishing the bad habit before trying to adopt the good is one not unfamiliar to Jewish culture. King David famously wrote, "Turn away from doing evil, and then do good. Seek and pursue total completion." Jewish tradition has always seen this verse to be advising people not to attempt the difficult acquisition of good habits before getting rid of the bad. The recommended sequence is to first stop doing the destructive activity, then embark on making the good and desired activity part of your life. Finally, you can integrate it all into the new and complete you. Imagine a man wanting to lose weight, for example. He knows that he must stop doing one bad thing, overeating. He also knows that he must start doing one good thing, such as physically exerting himself more. It wouldn't make sense for him to embark on a rigorous exercise routine while still indulging himself with too much of the wrong kinds of food. Perhaps he smokes cigarettes, too. In that case, he should surely wean himself from the two unhealthful habits while he gradually begins to ramp up his exercise program. In another example, a woman wanting to begin planning for her financial future should first eliminate unnecessary spending before setting out the details of her investment program. How do you find the determination and the discipline to cease destructive behavior that has become deeply ingrained in your personality? Part of the answer is, as I mentioned earlier in this chapter, to recognize the two parts of your personality that vie for control. It is never as simple or as easy as just saying no, but standing up to the seductive suggestions of your destructive side is a little easier when you know to whom you are talking. Here are just two of the destructive things that people do, and that can be eliminated relatively easily from their behavioral repertoire. Step 1. Admit your weaknesses. The first step is to acknowledge that you do dumb things. A question I force myself to confront regularly is this: which of the actions I am currently taking or contemplating will, in the future, appear to be fully as stupid as those of last year, last month, and last week? With hindsight, I usually have a pretty good idea of what stupid mistakes I made last year, last month, or last week. I also know that at the time, my actions seemed prudent and rational to me. Frankly, they frequently even appeared brilliant for a while, until the full folly of my errors sank in. Therefore, contemplating that question will save me grief in the future. Step 2. Don't get angry or lose control. Few of the stupid things you do are more stupid than allowing yourself to grow angry. When you're angry, you're out of control. Helen Gurley Brown, who ran Cosmopolitan magazine for more than 30 years, put it well. "Thou may not lose one's temper in an office, especially if thou art the boss. Out of control by you means in control by them. You've lost it." As I made clear at the beginning of this book, if who you are and what you do fail to bring the success you desire, it is not sufficient to merely do different things. You also need to become a different person. The best way, and perhaps the only way, to become a different person is by forcing yourself to do different things until they become second nature. In essence, when those things have become part of you, then you will have become different, and that is exactly what you need to do. It will be devastating for your career if your colleagues cannot rely on you to keep on an even emotional keel. During my work advising corporate leaders, the issue of anger surfaces virtually every time I ask. Do you have any executives in your company around whom people feel they must walk on eggshells for fear of setting off an out-of-control emotional explosion? There nearly always is such a person. Could it be you? You dramatically increase your value to others if you always maintain a calm and pleasant manner. What is the reason that some folks seem to slide so easily over the edge of self-control and inflict their vicious tempers on all who are unfortunate enough to be in the vicinity? Do they not know the costs that their tempers impose on their careers? The answer is that anger is one of the most self-destructive of all human behaviors. It shatters romantic, social, and business relationships, and rightly so. Why should anyone have to endure the abuse regularly dished out by someone who can't control his temper? The 12th century scholar Rabbi Moses Maimonides can offer assistance. He pointed out that most human attributes have their purposes, with the exception of anger. You see, his brilliant insight was that characteristics such as cruelty, compassion, truthfulness, and lying simply do not exist isolated and alone. Instead, each can only find meaning when placed at one extreme of a spectrum with its antonymic mate at the opposite extreme. Going to one extreme of the spectrum and delivering cold, heartless truth can often be as wrong as going to the other end of that spectrum and lying indiscriminately. When a friend has just spent a lot of money on a non-returnable purchase, he or she often asks your opinion. Here is where dishonesty becomes a virtue. This is really simple. Had the friend truly desired your opinion, he or she would have consulted you before the purchase. "Todd, do you like the BMW 545i? I'm considering buying." Or, "Nancy, how do you think I'd look in a simple little black frock?" No, when you are asked for an opinion following the purchase, it is not callous honesty that is required, but kindness and affirmation. Someone who is constantly over at the cruel end of the spectrum is a tyrant. At the opposite extreme is the person who dwells way over at the compassion end of that spectrum. It is not pleasant to work for a cruel person who lacks all compassion. But it is also tiresome to work for a boss who lacks sufficient cruelty to sometimes discipline a malingering fellow worker, or to deny an out-of-place request. One needs the ability to summon up the attribute of firmness, which can sometimes look like cruelty. Similarly, regarding compassion as the ultimate value and right guide for every circumstance means that you will never be able to negotiate with firmness and strength. It would be equally mistaken to negotiate harshly with complete disregard for the feelings of the other party. Ideal negotiation is transaction sculpting. It is designing a win-win outcome which enhances the relationship between the parties. This desirable outcome is far easier to envisage while keeping one's focus on the midpoint of the characteristic spectrum. Here is another circumstance in which I keep the midpoint rule in mind. When hiring executives, I usually ask, "How would you go about firing someone whose performance in your department is inadequate?" While the interviewee thinks about my question, and while he or she responds, I watch for body language as much as I listen to the reply. I want to hire people who will suffer real pain if they have to fire someone. I want someone who won't get a wink of sleep the night before he or she is to terminate a subordinate's employment. But I also want someone who nonetheless will unhesitatingly come in the next day and fire the underperforming employee and take whatever steps are necessary to preserve the safety and the integrity of corporate assets under the control of the departing associate. Instead of simple-mindedly regarding some attributes like kindness as good, and others like miserliness as bad, it is better to move to and fro along the spectrum line as circumstances demand. Maimonides suggested usually hovering around the middle on all these spectrum lines, with the exception of anger. Thus you can see that almost every human characteristic, both positive and negative, has its place, with the exception of anger. There is never any circumstance that demands that you become angry. Please note that I do not say never display anger. Instead, I say never be angry. In other words, there may well be many management situations, both at home and at work, where radiating an impression of being really upset, even angry, might be called for. But that is entirely different from really being angry. Being angry means you are out of control. What causes anger? Arrogance. Show me someone who readily loses his temper and showers those around him with angry yells and insults, and I'll show you a very arrogant man. Anger is the emotion you feel when you are not being treated with what you consider to be appropriate respect. When I erupt in obscene fury at a traffic jam that threatens to make me tardy for an appointment, what I am really saying is, "How dare they? How dare they make me late? Don't they know how important I am?" Were I to be as humble as I should be, almost nothing would make me feel anger. When my hammer hits my finger instead of the nail, my subsequent anger reflects not only the momentary surge of pain, but also the disparity I see between my importance and the trivial postponing of my picture-hanging goal. The final fact I must tell you is that there is a common misperception about anger. I have heard so many folks tell one another, "If you feel that angry, tell 'em. It isn't healthy to bottle it up." Wrong. It is very healthy to bottle it up. In fact, the more you bottle it up, the less frequently will you find yourself feeling overwhelmed by anger. The best way of dramatically reducing your own stress, as well as that of all those who must interact with you, is simply to stop allowing yourself to react angrily to anyone. Take a deep breath, take a walk, or take an aspirin. But whenever you feel anger welling up inside you, do not allow it past your teeth. I know this sounds funny, but I guarantee it works. This advice is a staple of what has guided Jewish business professionals for generations, and I have watched it work repeatedly within companies that I have counseled on these anger management techniques. Stop showing your anger, and you will soon stop feeling it. In addition, watch that arrogance factor. If you frequently feel anger, it may be a useful arrogance barometer for you. The more you think of yourself, the less significant everyone else looks by comparison. And how dare such insignificant beings bother you? Getting to know yourself is an ongoing part of the adventure of life. One of the perks of maturing is getting to know yourself a little better. One of the marks of sanity is seeing yourself pretty much as others see you. In your quest to increase the amount of money that flows toward you, getting to know yourself is vital. However, it comes with some risks. Sometimes you do not much like the person you come to know. It is important that as you get to know yourself, and as this process stimulates the desire to improve certain characteristics, you evade the terrible trap of perfectionism. You can often find yourself paralyzed into total immobility by your reluctance to settle for anything less than perfection. This, and some of the other perils of perfectionism will be seen in the next chapter. Your path to prosperity. Set aside a short period each day during which your sole purpose is to become your own harshest critic. Rigorously maintain an utterly private record of each day's successes and failures in winning the struggle. Create a confidential file in your laptop computer, your personal digital assistant, or your paper organizer that you update without fail each weekday night before retiring. Briefly record each decision you confronted during the day that demanded a courageous or noble response. Detail whether or not you rose to the challenge. In the event that you did not, candidly examine the conflicting tugs you experienced, and write a few sentences describing what would have been the superior decision. Finally, analyze whether there is any corrective action for you to take in the near future. Do this at the end of every single weekday. It only takes about 5 minutes maximum, but the impact of this little exercise is impossible to overestimate. You will begin feeling the difference in no more than a week. As difficult decisions are demanded of you during your working day, share the emotional conflict you are undergoing with your associates. Let your associates know and understand that you are not endowed with superhuman powers, and that you feel the temptations of the unwise course of action. After laying out the alternatives, if you can then resolutely take the harder path, you not only strengthen yourself, but you also encourage your employees and reinforce their perception of you as an effective leader. Seek out small battles to win in your private life. If you are committed to a diet regimen or to an exercise routine, you know only too well the compelling call of that destructive voice that earnestly reassures you that weight loss isn't terribly important. Winning that round will make you feel invincible and will endow you with additional spiritual resources for winning the next round. Start drawing up an inventory of your skills. No matter how irrelevant some skills might seem, write them down. Then, alongside each skill or aptitude, write down the kinds of people who might benefit from those skills. Now, brainstorm all the possible environments in which other people might encounter or seek those specific skills. Be open to the possibility that you are not currently deploying your most marketable skills to best or exclusive effect. For instance, Linda in Los Angeles was an experienced editor. She had worked on editing manuscripts for publishers, and she had edited various newspapers and journals. Helping a friend apply to graduate school one day, she discovered an opportunity. In order to win precious seats in graduate school, candidates had to submit essays that described themselves and their life goals. She began to specialize in helping graduate students write winning essays to the schools of their choice. She now employs several ex-editors in her own thriving business, Accepted.com, which serves graduate school applicants nationwide. Find out how you really spend your time. Keep in mind the old adage, time is money. This is part of the secret of compound interest. Time is truly the only commodity of which you are genuinely in short supply. You must now start taking charge of your time. And you do this by finding out just how you are spending it. First, chart how you use your time for a period of a week, 2 weeks, or even a month. It depends on what works best for you. The key is to emerge from this exercise knowing how you spend your time. Lay out the period's worth of days with enough space to detail how each hour went by, either on a large sheet of paper placed on the wall in some private location, or on an electronic handheld digital assistant. At the end of the time period, ignore time legitimately spent on sleep, dining, exercise, and so on. Then, carefully tabulate the 8 to 10 hours that you have available each day for economic productivity. Find out whether your efforts were driven by your plans and your agenda, or whether you were responding haphazardly to random stimuli. Determine the difference between important things that may not be urgent and urgent things that may not be important. For example, acquiring a new skill or searching for a better job may well be important, but each is not an urgent task. Job searching is easy to constantly postpone because your existing job is paying the bills. Reading the morning paper, surfing 11 news sites on the internet, and opening your mail are all urgent because they convey timely data. However, they are not very important to your future wealth. Discover how your time is being spent, and you may be surprised, even horrified. Now accustom yourself to seeing yourself as your own boss. As your boss, don't you want your employee, that is you, to put in a full day's work? Sure you do. So make sure that the hours set aside for wealth creation each day are dedicated to just that. Later on, you will see more clearly how to organize your time productively for the things that count. You will learn which activities are worth focusing on and which are expendable. The Fourth Commandment: Do not pursue perfection. Neither neglect the imperfect, nor expend yourself on futile pursuit of perfection, while failing to make the most of less perfect circumstances. You know that life isn't perfect. This awareness is rooted in your spiritual nature. It is only within the most abstract part of your being that you can conceive of an ultimate perfection for which part of us constantly yearns. There is nothing wrong with that yearning, so long as you never allow it to paralyze you. Stay aware of perfection, but never allow it to sideline you to the spectator stands in the game of life and business. Which of the choices do you like less? Life often boils down to being able to function within less than ideal circumstances. Take, for instance, the constant criticisms of business and of the entire socioeconomic system in which you operate. Does it function perfectly for all people all the time? No, of course, it does not. I would wager that there have been many times that you have felt that you did not receive the rewards you deserved. I know that I have felt this. Slightly less enthusiastically, I have also been compelled to acknowledge that on many occasions I have enjoyed rewards that I did not deserve. The system is not perfect. Everyone agrees on that. Judaism has taught that people should operate as best as they can within the imperfection, because idealistic perfection is unattainable by human beings. Once I recognize that fallible human beings can never create a truly perfect economic system, I can also recognize that the present system in which I live and function is an amazingly successful one. When something goes terribly wrong with an airplane in midair, and it plunges into the ocean, countless investigators gather to probe the catastrophe and to find out why the airplane fell out of the sky. Without meaning to be flippant, I can provide the only accurate answer in one word: gravity. The real question is not why the airplane fell. That is obvious. The natural condition is for everything to fall to earth. The real question is, what kept the airplane up there in the first place? It remained airborne because its engines converted much of the chemical energy stored in fuel into thrust. It had wings that could convert thrust into lift. Remove any one of these vital elements, and the natural effect of gravity will take its sad course. The U.S. socioeconomic system is similar. Many well-intentioned people also constantly convene meetings to probe the root causes of poverty. They question what brought the plane down, or why everyone isn't airborne and wealthy. The answer is simple, if unpopular. Poverty is normal, just as a plane on the ground is more normal than one in the air. This is true even though Americans are unaccustomed to real poverty. Smart people should really flock to conferences to probe the root causes of wealth. Just as it is normal for objects dropped off a roof to fall to earth, so it is perfectly normal for wealth to slide down the slope to poverty. It takes enormous energy to boost a 100-ton airplane off a runway, and it takes enormous energy to create a society of wealth. A society of wealth is not made any less amazing by the fact that some, or even many individuals in that society, own less than many others. When you examine almost any society that has succeeded in lifting many of its citizens above the level of day-to-day subsistence, you are likely to find some in that society who have considerably less than others. There is little reason to indict a society on account of those in it who have less. The miracle is that virtually nobody is struggling for actual survival. The condition of those who have less than others, even a lot less, is sad, but normal. However, there is much reason to praise a society that has lifted the lives of most of its citizens well above the level of daily need and fear, even if it has not done so for everybody. Although society should do its best to make it possible for everyone to improve his or her lot, and each citizen should be able to find a way to advance his or her economic interests, expecting the same results for all people is pursuing a perfection that does not exist anywhere in the real world. For most people, life continues to be what it has always been, an attempt to wrestle the most comfortable life possible from an often reluctant earth. There is a view that has inspired Jewish efforts in this arena. It is seen from the entire structure of Scripture, and emerges from 3,000 years of oral transmission. The view is that the entire Bible encapsulates the following pact that God made with humanity. If you try to endure, each of you on your own, then your life will be hard and short. However, if you learn how to cooperate with others, and you structure a peace-loving society that follows certain basic rules, there is no limit to how comfortable you can become. Now you choose. Don't blame business because of a few unethical business people. Conceding that many imperfections exist in the system that allows humans to cooperate economically is not the same as discrediting the entire enterprise of business, nor is it reason to do so. Yes, there have been many business professionals that have behaved scandalously. Business is a tool of human cooperation, and like any tool, it can be misused and abused. However, you should distinguish between judging certain conduct by business professionals as unethical and judging business itself. Only humans are capable of making moral decisions, and only humans can be judged and held accountable for those decisions and for the actions that flow from them. Like a sharp scalpel that can be used for healing in the hands of a dedicated surgeon, or for assault in the hands of a thug, business can bring goodness and hope to all, or it can hurt. Jewish tradition helps clarify one's view of the legal landscape by reminding that inanimate objects can never be blamed for causing distress of any kind. Only the people in charge of those objects can and ought to be held responsible. When a drunken driver slays a pedestrian, no sane person contemplates the moral deterioration of motor cars and impounds the offending vehicle. You could rightly throw the book at the driver, that human who made the decision to drink and drive. Of course, some business, philosophic, and political systems do exist that tend to provide incentive for immoral conduct and to reward misbehavior. I would argue that the system of ethical capitalism that has shaped commerce in the United States of America, one greatly influenced by a Judeo-Christian worldview, has for the most part been an honorable arrangement. When things go horribly wrong in a company or business, and from time to time they do, blaming business as an imperfect system merely obscures the identity of the real villain, the human in charge who made wrong and often illegal or immoral decisions. Why is business excoriated when other professions are excused? Other professions don't get blamed the same way that business does. For example, occasionally a rogue doctor cold-bloodedly murders patients. Naturally, the sensational nature of the gruesome discovery guarantees extensive media coverage. Yet no one suggests that the practice of medicine is inherently immoral. When, as occasionally happens, a teacher is discovered to be abusing students, people seldom blame the system of education. Horrible stories of rape and assault by professional athletes can often be found in newspapers, and the personal lives of entertainers reveal the full spectrum of human folly. Yet there are few calls for government to step in and minutely examine and regulate the sports and entertainment industries. However, when those running businesses act wrongfully and unethically, the media often suggest that their behavior is the norm and only to be expected by those in such a questionable occupation. The world of politics itself has more than its fair share of exploiters of women and practitioners of financial skullduggery. The public rightly condemns those elected representatives and frequently denies them re-election. But no one suggests abandoning the Constitution for another system entirely. I don't deny that there are quite abominable people who earn their livings, often very good ones, in business. You have all met such people. They do exist, and are not people with whom you'd want to spend a social evening. I myself have met many, and I make no effort to defend them. I consider them to be parasites. They indulge themselves in selfish, egotistical, and often cruel behavior, the kind of conduct that undermines and imperils the very system that lavishes its benefits on them. They are not the natural products of a system of free and virtuous economic interaction. They are destructive aberrations. Not only do these abominable business people bring disgrace on a noble and honorable way of earning a living, they also demoralize everyone else engaged in honest business. Because of them, people repeat sayings like, "Nice guys never win." Decades of exemplary business conduct, during which time a company may have provided jobs for thousands of families and desirable goods for the entire world, can be obliterated by sensational news accounts of misconduct. For example, it seems likely that Monsanto Company discharged dangerous residue into creeks and landfills around the small town of Anniston, Alabama. Monsanto enjoyed a nearly 40-year virtual monopoly on producing a range of industrial coolants known as PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls. Now known to be dangerous, PCBs were once hailed as miracle chemicals. They are non-flammable, and they conduct heat without conducting electricity. Many safety codes mandated their use as insulation in electrical equipment, such as transformers. Most people would probably consider it improper to excoriate Monsanto Company for manufacturing something in 1929 that at the time wasn't generally known to be dangerous. However, the company's internal memos that have come to light indicate actions taken by Monsanto executives that should indeed be condemned. The case is being made that senior people knew, or at least suspected, that they were harming the neighboring community. For example, internal memos emblazoned with warnings such as "confidential, read and destroy," show that in 1966, Monsanto managers discovered that fish dunked into a creek poisoned with PCBs died within seconds. In September 1969, Monsanto appointed a committee to address the controversy. The minutes of one of the committee meetings reveal that two formal objectives were permit continued sales and profits and protect the image of Monsanto. The idea was to maintain one of Monsanto's most profitable franchises as long as possible, while taking care to reduce our exposure in terms of liability. In other words, it appears that Monsanto leaders did engage in truly reprehensible behavior. Similarly, consider the Enron case. When Enron declared bankruptcy on December 2, 2001, it was the largest Chapter 11 filing in U.S. history. Everyone should perhaps be somewhat indignant. Every legitimate business professional has been hurt, not because he or she necessarily knows everything that took place or understands exactly how Enron's 3,000-plus partnerships were used to put some debt off the books. No. Every business professional has been hurt because of the appearance of flagrant impropriety. Everyone heard news accounts of documents destroyed surreptitiously. Everyone heard accounts of how thousands of workers lost significant savings while senior executives had miraculously sold their stock, in some cases 6 months or more prior to the calamity. Everyone heard how during summer 2001, Sharon Watkins, an Enron executive who had earlier worked for Enron's auditors, Arthur Anderson, expressed worries that Enron might turn out to be an elaborate accounting hoax in her 7-page letter to Enron chairman and chief executive Kenneth Lay. These accounts feed popular misconceptions about business in ways that would be almost impossible to counter effectively. The institution of business and the profession of business have been dreadfully harmed by the collapse of what had been regarded as the 7th largest U.S. company. During the fall of 2001, so much public outrage accumulated about these Enron stories that Congress convened more than 8 hearings into the scandal. But focus on the real villains, urged the Wall Street Journal, rather than on the system. Quote, all of which means that while Enron pension story is tragic, it's more about specific corporate blunders and wrongdoing than it is about flaws in pension law or 401ks. It's certainly no excuse for Congress to lobotomize a private pension system that has given millions of Americans a comfortable retirement, unquote. Although some companies have destroyed evidence of wrongdoings and perpetrated cover-ups, the vast majority of commercial enterprises steadfastly refrain from anything even remotely approaching impropriety. The astounding fact is not that wrongs have been committed by commerce and industry, but just how seldom these wrongs have taken place. It bears remembering that these events make the news precisely because they are relatively uncommon. This does not in any way excuse the conduct of the individuals, but it is a reminder that it would be wrong to indict the entire system. What is obscured by major scandals such as these is that these unethical individuals constitute a tiny but visible minority. Far more common are the ideal business professionals, the practitioners of what I term ethical capitalism, who through honor and virtue nourish and sustain the system, while benefiting themselves and their families. It is surely a tribute to the inherent strength and goodness of the vast and wonderful network of human economic interaction that a few saboteurs are incapable of utterly destroying it for everyone. The robber barons weren't evil. They created good, too. Few people are all evil or all good. Each person is a complex amalgam of emotions, aspirations, and moral coordinates. Sometimes people do wonderfully noble things, and other times they can act in ways that leave them loathing themselves. Far more often, though, people's actions themselves are complex. One reason that universal moral agreement can be so elusive is that most actions are combinations of good and bad. Suppose I bestow a lavish gift on my daughter. This is a good, selfless action that you will always remember fondly. But it may also have negative consequences, such as causing jealousy in her siblings, or postponing her achieving independence. Everyone must learn to identify and credit the good components in complex actions and complex people, and one group of notorious individuals provides us with an ideal laboratory. During the 19th century, there arose business titans who strode across the landscape of the United States. Being human, none were saints, but neither were they all sinners. Were some of the moguls dreadfully unpleasant people? Of course. The legend of the company store and news stories of substandard company housing were often true. For example, the Pullman Company was found to have rented compulsory housing to its workers and required them to buy their food, fuel, and water through the company at above market rates that were enormously profitable. It was not uncommon for workers' paychecks to be outweighed by their debts. There were ignoble and mean-spirited scoundrels among the wealthy industrialists. However, that was not the rule. Neither should it have impugned an entire generation of builders. Among them were many admirable souls. Here, in his own words, is Andrew Carnegie's reaction to receiving his first week's earnings at the age of 12 years old. "I cannot tell you how proud I was when I received my first week's earnings. $1.20 made by myself and given to me because I had been of some use in the world. No longer entirely dependent on my parents, but at last admitted to the family partnership as a contributing member and able to help them. I think this makes a man out of a boy sooner than almost anything else, and a real man, too, if there be any germ of true manhood in him. It is everything to feel that you are useful." That may not be a saint speaking, but neither is it a robber speaking. Citizens of dozens of towns and cities around the United States still benefit from Carnegie's philanthropy every time they enter their local library. Parks, universities, and hospitals are some of the other benefits these generous entrepreneurs bestowed on their nation. Yet, Carnegie and his fellow tycoons were later dubbed robber barons. During their lives, for the most part, they were viewed realistically, just as flawed as other people, but having done more good than most. Consider another less well-known example. James Jerome Hill was born in a log cabin in Ontario, Canada, in 1838. His father died while the boy was young, and he supported his mother by working in a grocery for $4 a month. Through great energy and hard work, Hill came to build a railroad across the Northwest. His concept was to build the line slowly, and first develop the economy of the area before continuing on further. To attract immigrants, Hill offered to bring them to the Northwest for a mere $10 each if they would farm near his railroad. He organized farming instruction classes that taught the newly arrived farmers all about local conditions and such techniques as diversifying crops. He imported 7,000 head of cattle from England and handed them over, free of charge, to settlers near his line. Hill told the immigrants who worked near his railroad that he and they were all in the same boat together. He explained to them that they would either all prosper together or all be poor together. To make sure that they prospered, he also set up experimental farms to test new seed, livestock, and equipment. He sponsored contests and awarded rich prizes to those farmers who most successfully produced meat and wheat in bounty. Was he doing all this out of selfless altruism? No, of course not. He did these things to build up the future customers of his railroad. By helping them prosper, he was ensuring that he would ultimately prosper too, when his railroad would provide the only export facilities for the agricultural produce of these early settlers. He subsidized, assisted, and built infrastructure in order to become wealthy. However, you can be quite sure of one thing. Those pioneers who obtained $10 passages from overcrowded tenements to a promised land, those farmers who received gifts of 7,000 English cows and bulls, and all the others who built new lives alongside Hill's railroad, felt only gratitude to this man. This view changed during the Great Depression, when a left-wing extremist named Matthew Josephson wrote a book called The Robber Barons that was published in 1934. Until that time, the 19th century had been seen as a period of unprecedented economic boom. Naturally, not everyone became rich, but most people began enjoying a standard of living of which their parents could only have dreamed. The economic prowess of those whom Josephson considered to be robbers definitely freed virtually everyone from drudgery. Whether it was availability of oil, train transport, or the limitless variety of new products, almost everyone lived better than had been the case only a few years earlier. Yet Josephson's nasty little book was rumored to be required reading among Washington's new dealers, who saw Josephson's greedy tycoons as emblems of the corrupt economic system that had brought about the Great Depression. As Walter Donway put it, "And as bank failures avalanched, and the Depression's misery set in, it was handy to have Josephson's gallery of villains, and his taunting evocations of their riches, to divert attention from the Federal Reserve System's role in the economic collapse, and the protectionist folly of the Smoot-Hawley Act. With its damning portraits and Marxist analysis, the Robber Barons became a kind of instant classic, and its epithet title achieved a currency out of all proportion to the book's merit. Like Josephson, today's moralists equate large profits with ill-gotten gain, as if such profits were in themselves proof of wrongdoing. When you take luxuries for granted, things must be pretty good." Much must be right about the economic system in the United States because it allows Americans to take so much luxury for granted. There is a sentiment often expressed that uses its high tone to obscure just how wonderful a well-running economic system is. Have you heard folks saying things like, "Why not take the day off and spend it with the family?" Or, "Nobody ever dies regretting not having spent enough time at work." Those are very pretty notions, but they can be said only by someone with no fear at all of having to put his children to bed that night, hungry and frightened. In some countries at this time, and particularly in earlier times, many parents have been tormented not by spending enough time with their children,